We're discussing with our broadcast partners the details behind the headlines that you may be reading in the newspaper, our hearing and radio and television reports. Now, we believe this is essential for the body of Christ so that indeed they can understand exactly what is happening in this world and then put that alongside their study of the prophetic passages in God's Word. If indeed you're going to be able to have a better understanding about current events in light of biblical prophecy, you have to focus on the Middle East. You have to focus on the Jewish people in the city of Jerusalem. That's what we do with David Dolan. David has lived in Jerusalem from that vantage point. He's been able to look at current events unfolding for a number of years, almost 25 years now. A journalist par excellence, working with CBS Radio and other organizations that gather the news out of the Middle East. And David's been able to analyze what's happening. And that's why we're so thrilled to have him alongside of us as a broadcast partner here. David, thank you for being available. And let me get to what I would probably consider somewhat of a lead story as you look at the Middle East. You have the Palestinians. There's two factions, Hamas, which you have written extensively about. In fact, you were basically the first journalist to warn the rest of the world about Hamas. But Hamas and Fatah, that would be the two factions of the body politic of the Palestinian people. And now one of the ministers in the Palestinian Authority, which is the legislative body for the Palestinians, one of those ministers joined with a number of others who have endorsed his call. They're calling for the Palestinians to unite so that they can destroy Israel. That sounds like a call for war. Is that what you think it is, or what would you say about it?
Well, it's really, yes, it is a call for war, for sure, but it's really going back to the situation, if it were to happen, that is, that existed before the PLO leader Yasser Arafat decided in 1988 to pursue a peace process and to try to make peace with Israel. So until that time, of course, the PLO charter was calling for Israel's destruction, and it still did for many years after that, as you'll recall, a battle to actually get that charter to reflect what Arafat was saying and the things he was signing, the peace accord he signed in 93. Of course, Hamas totally opposed that from the get-go, and that was what really brought the split between the two sides. At that time, in the early 90s, the PLO didn't think anything of it, the Fatah movement that's from the PLO, because Hamas was a small fringe group. And as you say, I wrote in my first book that while they were indeed that at the time, I expected them to grow and become a major political force precisely because they reflect a more accurate Islamic view of a Jewish state, that it cannot exist, that it must be destroyed, that land that Muslims once ruled must always be ruled by Muslims and not by infidels, etc. So now that they are a major faction and have been for the last 10 years or so, and having won the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections, Hamas is a major force to be dealt with. And, of course, they actually control part of the Palestinian territories in the Gaza Strip. So to see this reconciliation would be a disaster for Israel, because they know that the militant side, the side that wants the war to continue, wants the peace treaty abrogated, would prevail. They're an all-or-nothing sort of view, and you know, it may be that some in Fatah are just recognizing that this is the way the wind's blowing. We had Barghouti say, who's in jail, who many believe should be replaced Yasser Arafat, and not Mahmoud Abbas, say we have to return to the path of war, that peace isn't working. So this is a growing thing, Jimmy, and it's certainly not one that the Israelis can be very happy to hear.
Now, David, for the last couple of years, there has been this process of reconciliation going on between Fatah and Hamas. Now, this is a pretty serious call. As we said, both of us agreeing, this is a call for war. But is it reality? Can these two factions really unite at this point in history?
It's a possibility, but I think only if Fatah totally renounced the peace process. And again, we have Marwan Barghouti, who's in jail, but who many believe should be the leader of Fatah. It was the natural heir of Arafat. Democrat, as many of them put it. We have him calling for the cessation of all peace talks and saying this, we've tried this, it's failed, it's not working, we have to revert back to the path of jihad. So if Fatah were to basically adopt Hamas's position, then a true reconciliation, there would still be rivalries and intrigues, and the Arab world is full of that anyway, but they could at least unite on a single platform. I don't see Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, or the Fayyad, the prime minister, or some of the other current Fatah leaders doing that, though, Jimmy, because they will lose all international support. They would lose a lot of financial support from the United States, from Europe, from Japan, other major donors. So unless somebody else could step in with the same amount of money and aid on the ground, I think they will be reluctant to go that path.
David, I see developing on the East Bank, not the West Bank, the East Bank of the Jordan River, something very interesting and has a connection to what we're talking about here. King Abdullah making a decision that he's going to follow the example of his father and try to divorce himself from the Palestinians. And the reason for that is these men are not of Palestinian background. They're of Hashemite background from Saudi Arabia. But that's interesting. This is developing right now with the king wanting to divorce himself from the Palestinians.
Well, basically, Jimmy, you're right in saying the Hashemite family comes from Mecca, comes from Saudi Arabia. Well, it was then called Arabia. It was the Saud family that came in the early 1920s and had a civil war against the Hashemites that were then ruling Arabia and forced them out. And it was the British that, as part of the mandate process, that gave the current King Abdullah's great-grandfather, who was also named Abdullah, that little land, carved that land out and called it Transjordan, and later Jordan, and also created Iraq and gave that to another member of the royal family to rule over, and a few other things that I won't detail. But so there's always been an uncomfortableness between the Hashemite rulers and the Palestinians who live in Jordan, who many demographers believe are 60% to 70% of the people. Would call themselves Palestinians. In other words, they trace their families to the west side of the river, the west bank of the river, either in Israel proper or the disputed territories. And many of them hope to return to ancestral homes in these areas if there is a final peace treaty or a final war that destroys Israel. So that's the situation. But I don't see how it's realistic that King Abdullah can do that because, again, a majority of the people residing in his own borders call themselves Palestinians. So it's not very easy to divorce yourself from that conundrum, that problem, that conflict that's been going on. And King Hussein, of course, did it when he renounced Jordanian control over the West Bank, what he called the West Bank of the Kingdom of Jordan, and in 1988. And it's since, of course, has been under either Israeli control exclusively or partial Palestinian control, and that's where it remains today. But I understand he would like to get away from it, but I don't see how that's going to be practically possible.
And meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the quartet made up of the United States, European Union, United Nations, and Russia, being led by Tony Blair, the peace envoy for the quartet, trying to bring peace in the Middle East. They're getting together to have a discussion to see if indeed they can bring some type of resolution to this conflict. And at the same time, interesting to me, they didn't accuse the settlements, the Jewish settlers, of being the problem any more than they did the violence out of the Palestinians that are attacking and sending rockets over. So what's going on there?
Well, Jimmy, you know, the Israelis said it was the most balanced statement from the quartet they've heard in some time. They usually lash out at Israel at least as much as the Palestinians. But these statements come and these statements go, and whether they ever have any real effect on the situation on the ground is very, very questionable. So another meeting, another statement.
I did mention the situation in Syria. We don't know what's going on from moment to moment. I mean, how could you and I, we're on the air now, how could we know definitely what's happening? It looks to me they're getting ready to send UN monitors in. It doesn't look to me like it's going to be successful, but you've been in that part of the world for a number of years. What do you think about Bashar Assad's decision to make this agreement for a ceasefire? Do you think he'll stick by it? Do you think the opposition will stand by it? What are your thoughts?
I mean, he really had no choice at this point but to agree, because even his close allies, Russia, Iran, and China, were saying that you have to do something here. We're in the modern world where we have media, we have YouTube, we have the internet, etc., and you cannot hide the fact that hundreds of people a week are being slaughtered in this ongoing internal conflict there, most of them by the regime's military and security forces, many of them civilians. And when it got to the point this earlier this week that Assad was ordering the shelling of some of his own people, refugees that were in camps inside of Turkey and inside of Lebanon, then it really boiled over into an international situation. And Turkey, which of course is a NATO ally, a Muslim country, but a NATO ally, made clear that it would not put up with this. And the Saudis are demanding international intervention and are funneling funds and money to the rebels, and the U.S. is sending them some aid, etc. So he can't, Assad just couldn't pretend like there was no pressure out there upon him. But the expectation from what I'm hearing, my sources, are that he will do the minimum necessary to try to keep them off his back while continuing to try to crush this rebellion. And, of course, the rebel leaders, the Free Syrian Army leaders, have made clear they're not going to lay down their arms either. They're going to fight until he is overthrown. He's made clear he's not going to allow himself to be overthrown. So it seems to me we have a recipe here, Jimmy, for continuing conflict throughout this year, and it might be even longer than that, and something that that is sad, of course, for the people caught in the middle of it.
David, you reported to us in the past that Bashar Assad, if he comes under enough pressure, may actually strike out at Israel, move his military forces into the Golan Heights, start attacking both Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Haifa. Do you have any idea that at this time, this may be a motivating factor for Assad to reach out and start going against Israel?
Well, it was an old Soviet tactic, Jimmy, that whenever you had internal pressure, you looked for an external enemy to divert people's attention to. And it's true that these Muslims fighting against the regime are mostly Sunni Muslims. They're not favorable to Israel. They're more on a kilt of Hamas or Islamic Jihad, these Palestinian Sunni Muslim groups that want to see Israel destroyed. So they're no friends of Israel. So it's a tactical choice that he may indeed take to try to divert attention. And the Israelis certainly are aware of this possibility and are preparing for it very, very much. I've been hearing of reinforcements of forces in the north recently and anti-missile batteries and these sorts of things. You never know. When you get a brutal dictator like this cornered, you never know what he can do. And that is that is what's keeping Israeli leaders up at night right now.
Yeah, the old out west adage is corner a rattlesnake and he'll strike at you. That may be the case here. Well, you mentioned Turkey and the skirmishes going on there between Turkey and Syria there at the Turkish-Syrian border. In Istanbul, the group of world leaders from the major powers of the world are meeting together, a focus on the nuclear program there in Iran. We don't know a lot about it. Some reports coming out, everything is favorable, and in fact, Iran's acting different. Well, Iran has done that many times. They do these to lay tactics, and I think this possibly may be the case here. But what I really want to know is not so much of what's going on in Istanbul, but what the Israelis are thinking about this. Do they believe this is going to be effective, or are they still preparing to do their preemptive strike?
It seems, Jimmy, like that portion of the government and the military that is really, I would say, pushing for military action against Iran's program, simply because the option to do that is decreasing all the time since they're moving it deep underground into bunkers. They're not. They just believe, as you said, this is a delaying tactic. They knew that if they agreed to these talks, that the U.S. in particular would put strong pressure on Netanyahu not to take any action at this time against the Iranian program. And that is the prevailing view, I would say, in Israel. On the other hand, the President Obama did want to go forward with this. The European Union did, the others. And, you know, you never know. There is a chance that the United International Community's pressure on Iran and the economic consequences and that might cause the regime to back down from proceeding with its nuclear program. But there's sure no sign of that, no verbal sign of it or physical on the ground sign. So I think the Israelis believe this just gives Iran time to finish moving that program underground. And, you know, and then that option to attack them may be lost. So even despite the ongoing talks, we may see Israel strike anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's going to be an ongoing story that David and I will have discussions about in the future. The Syrian situation and the Iranian nuclear development of a weapon of mass destruction, that situation as well. Hey, David, let's end on a positive note. Earlier this week, we're in the week of Passover and unleavened bread, the celebration of one of the Jewish feasts. The report I understand about 70,000 Jewish worshipers went to the Western Wall for the traditional priestly blessing. Now, that is an unbelievable experience.
It is, and I've been there many times for it, Jimmy. It's just a half a mile away from where I live in Jerusalem, and it is a marvelous, I think it's the most moving ceremony of the year in terms of Judaism in the city. Fabulous, and of course it always comes right around the time of Resurrection Sunday and remembering the Lord's death and resurrection in that city. So it's a very, very special thing, and a biblical thing as well. So it comes from the scriptures, so something that God ordained, and I still believe it has that stamp upon it, whether they know the Lord personally or not.
Wow, I like that. The stamp of God on what took place, whether they know Jesus Christ as the true Messiah or not. God is having his way among his people. By the way, next week we're going to have a very special program on preparations to build the next temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. You do not want to miss Prophecy Today next weekend. And we're going to talk about some of the things that relate to the priestly blessings. And one of the points, of course, is that the temple, they want it up on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Hey, David, thanks a lot for being available. You did extra service today, but we appreciate it so much, and we'll talk again soon.
You're welcome. God bless you.